Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Domo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Before we get into it, you're reading today's episode, which is this one. And then you are also going to be getting Friday's episode from last week. I had migraines, could not get rid of them. I've been dealing with those a lot lately. So because of that, Friday's episode did not come out. So you're going to get that today, as well as this Friday's regular episode. So you're going to get all of your normal amount of episodes, just in the wrong order. So with that, we're going to get into it. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. The biting cold of a New England winter. The air thick with the smell of wood smoke, and it offers no comfort. Inside a simple colonial home, a young girl stares, wide-eyed, not at a demon in the shadows, but at a terror she alone can see. She clutches her throat, her face turning blue as she screams. She's being choked by an invisible hand. Her body twists, convulsing, her screams tearing at the quiet of the night, pointing at an invisible specter. Soon, other children join her in this terrifying dance. And in a village where God's wrath was as real as the winter wind, these agonizing cries would become the spark. A spark that would set neighbor against neighbor, turn reason into madness, and ultimately lead innocent souls to the gallows. This is Salem, 1692.
Damn. Cool.
So, this episode, I did specifically for Mandy, but she has not returned yet. So, we're still doing it. She's going to listen to these episodes get caught up before she comes back, and we'll talk about all of them with her then. So we'll get Mandy's thoughts when she gets
She'll look at me and go, "Mama, you're fired."
Okay, so imagine a small colonial village, winter's grip tightening on every street, when suddenly children begin convulsing, screaming and pointing at invisible attackers. No one can explain it, and soon lives will be claimed by fear itself. So like I said, we're in Salem, 1692. This is our Monday episode, and with only a few weeks left till Halloween. So, naturally, in the spirit of all that is spooky, and because Mandy loves it, we are going to dive into a tale that is full of Halloween spirit, as it is old. Settle in and step with me into one of the darkest chapters of American history. A time when fear could turn neighbor against neighbor, when whispered accusations could cost lives, and when the shadow of hysteria fell across a small colonial village. In this episode, we'll take a journey back to 1692 to Salem Village in Massachusetts, a tight-knit community gripped by suspicion, superstition, and panic. To understand Salem, we have to step into the Puritan mind. The devil wasn't an abstract idea. He was real, present, and actively working against them every day. Puritan ministers preached that the wilderness itself was his domain. Every howl of the wind in the trees, every strange rustle in the dark was proof of his hand. Sermons were filled with fire and brimstone, designed to terrify congregations into obedience. Ministers described hell in vivid, gruesome terms: lakes of fire, devils with claws and wings, eternal torment for the sinful. Children grew up with these images stamped into their minds. To disobey one's parents, to skip a prayer, even to laugh too loudly, all could be opening for the devil to creep in. It's a bit fucking dramatic, but whatever.
And some of them are still like that.
I know, but it's a bit dramatic. One well-known Puritan preacher, Cotton Mather, warned in his writings that Satan's followers were cunning and that they often appeared as ordinary neighbors. This belief created an environment where suspicion was inevitable. In Salem, you didn't have to look far to see the devil's work. a cow's milk spoiling, a child falling ill, or an argument between neighbors, all of it could be traced back to Salem, to Satan's hand, working through witches in the community. Life in Salem in the winter of 1692 was more than hard. It was suffocating. The cold pressed into every crack of every home. So bitter it seemed to gnaw at the bones. The air inside was heavy with smoke from damp green wood that smoldered instead of burned, leaving soot clinging to the walls and stinging the eyes. Families crowded together in a single room, coughing through the haze with no choice but to breathe it in. Meals were little comfort. Dark rye bread, often hard by the second day, salted pork that had been hacked apart and boiled just to make it chewable.
What?
Gross. Dried peas or cornmeal mush, filling but tasteless. I know, ew. Ooh, I would have starved to death.
I wouldn't be a little fat girl, that's for sure.
For children, there were no treats. No fruit in the dead of winter, and no sweetness except maybe a thin drizzle of molasses if the family could afford it. What's molasses?
It's like a very thick syrup. It's dark. It's a dark color.
Ew.
They use it a lot of time to make the rye bread or molasses cookies. Yeah. No, it's actually very good.
It sounds gross.
No, it's not, honey.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Everyday life was dictated by rhythm and necessity. At first light, the men and the older boys trudged into the field to tend to animals or chop wood, their boots crunching over frozen ground. Women stirred the fire back to life, set pots to boil, and corralled the younger children into their chores. Punishments were harsh and swift. Disobedience wasn't just a matter of family discipline. It was a sin against God. At night, families gathered for long prayers by the dim glow of tallow candles, shadows stretching along the timbered walls. Beyond the faint circle of light, darkness pressed in, absolute. Outside, wolves howled across the snowfields, their cries mingling with the moaning of the wind. The forest loomed at the edge of the village, vast and unknowable. For the Puritans, the wilderness wasn't just dangerous. It was the devil's domain, a place where unseen threats waited, watching. And always, there was fear. Fear of illness, measles, fever, smallpox. They could all sweep through a household in just days. Fear of God's wrath preached from the pulpit in sermons that thundered about hellfire. Fear that one wrong step, one hidden sin could condemn not only the sinner, but their entire family, their neighbors, and their entire community. In Salem, the devil wasn't some far-off figure in Scripture. He was near, close, waiting just outside the door in the winter dark. Beneath the supernatural charges of witches and devils, Salem was a community deeply divided by money and land. On one side were the Putnams, traditional farmers who believed in a simple agrarian way of life. On the other side were the Porters and their allies, merchants tied to Salem town and its growing trade economy. These factions clashed over politics, religion, and most of all, land. The witch trials provided a perfect weapon for these disputes. Many of the accused just happened to be aligned with the Porters, while their accusers were linked to the Putnams. When someone was condemned, their property could be seized or sold off, often to the very neighbors who had helped condemn them. Salem's hysteria wasn't just about fear of the devil. It was about opportunity. If a family wanted their neighbor's field, accusing them of witchcraft was one of the quickest paths to getting it.
Damn. Mm-hmm. Talk about brutal.
Right. This dark undercurrent of greed runs like a hidden thread throughout the entire story of Salem. Behind the shrieks of children and the sermons about hellfire, there were also cold calculations. Who stood to gain when someone was removed? In Salem, witch trials became a brutal extension of village politics. This constant oppressive religious terror was already mixed with the highly flammable social and economic tensions, but the fear that gripped Salem was amplified by pressures far beyond their own village borders. This fervor for finding the devil's mark was solidified by King James I, who was King James VI of Scotland. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. James I was personally obsessed with witchcraft. having been attacked, or so he believed, by witches in Scotland. So his book, Demonology, explicitly outlined the concept of the diabolic pact and was a guiding theological text for magistrates on both sides of the Atlantic. So it gave the courts a rigid formal structure for prosecuting witches as traitors to God and the king, making the trials a matter of state security, not just local gossip. So imagine living without a clear government. Every law felt temporary, fragile, and easily overturned. In 1684, the King of England had revoked the colony's original charter, plunging the entire region into a period of political chaos. And then adding to this internal stress was the very real external threat of King William's War. So now, before we go too far, we have to understand the full context of that external threat. And in order to do that, we have to look to the north. So many people flowing into Salem Village were refugees from the marine frontier, fleeing devastating raids by the Wabanaki Native Americans and their French allies during King William's War. These raids were bloody, sudden, and terrifying. Many of the afflicted girls, including Mercy Lewis, had witnessed family members be killed or captured in this conflict.
Damn.
So they carried that raw, unresolved trauma into Salem with them. For a Puritan, the image of a hostile savage, as they called him, coming out of the wilderness was indistinguishable from the devil's work. The constant fear of a real physical attack, a genuine invisible enemy, fed directly into the belief that Satan was actively recruiting agents within their own community to destroy them from the inside. So it's hard to fathom like people doing this to other people.
It happens today.
Right. But if you look at what was going on around them, you can kind of get it to a certain point.
Well, yeah, I can understand it, but it ain't any different than some of the crap that goes on today.
No, it's not. It was just a little bit more unruly back then. Okay, so by 1692, Salem Village was a powder keg, essentially. The arrival of these strange fits in Reverend Paris's home was simply the spark that ignited everything. This was the moment when Salem tipped from suspicion into outright hysteria. So before this all began, it's just a matter of time before Salem just blows up. And it all began, that spark began in one small home on a very cold and bitter February night. Outside, the icy bite of the February air made every breath a shallow pain. But the air was also thick with the smell of burning wood from banked hearths. Reverend Paris's enslaved woman, Tituba, had been sharing more than just stories with Elizabeth Paris and Abigail Williams. The girls had been participating in forbidden fortune-telling rituals using a Venus glass, which is a kind of primitive crystal ball made by floating an egg white in a glass of water. Kind of cool. So this was used to divine the identities of their future husbands. So simple shit teenagers do all the time here now in today's world. In that dark, tense atmosphere, this wasn't just a game, though, like it is today. It was a sin, a clear opening for the devil. And according to legend, one of the girls saw the terrifying shape of a coffin appear in the glass. So that very night, the first seizures began. A young girl screams violently, convulsing on the cold wooden floor, her fingers clawing at the air as though grasping invisible demons. The snow outside muffled sound, but inside the house, it was all shrieks and scratching. Every face is etched with fear. Doors are quickly locked against friends as the community's innate distrust takes root. No one understands what is happening, and no one can explain it. The behaviors of the afflicted girls went far beyond simple fainting fits. Witnesses reported them crawling under furniture, writhing on the ground like animals, and letting out sharp, guttural barks that terrified their families. Some claimed they saw visions of shadowy figures, pointing and screaming that invisible hands were choking them. Their bodies would stiffen so violently that adults could barely restrain them, and their voices twisted into sounds that seemed inhuman. For their families, this was more than frightening. It was devastating. In Puritan belief, children were supposed to be innocent instruments of God. Yet, here they were, acting as if possessed by Satan himself. Parents were torn between shame, fear, and pride. On one hand, these children appeared cursed. On the other, they seemed chosen to reveal hidden evil in their midst. Some parents began to believe their daughters were being used by God to expose the devil's followers. No accuser embodied this role more than 11-year-old Ann Putnam Jr. She was the most prolific witness, naming dozens of supposed witches and giving long, long detailed testaments about spectral attacks. Scholars believe Anne may have been influenced by her family's tensions. Her parents were embroiled in land disputes and bitter rivalries. For Anne, her role as an accuser gave her a rare kind of authority in a world where children, and especially girls, were usually powerless. In the space of a few months, she transformed from an overlooked child into one of the most powerful voices in Salem Village. The physician, Dr. William Griggs, suggested the unthinkable: witchcraft. The terror now had a name, and the first three women targeted were social outcasts: Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and Tituba. The accusations quickly moved beyond the immediate circle of the Parris' home. The first person to be brought to trial and executed was Bridget Bishop. Bishop was already infamous in Salem for her defiance of Puritan norms. She ran a tavern, wore clothes deemed too colorful and extravagant, and was known for squabbling with her neighbors. This pre-existing reputation as a social outsider meant the court was predisposed to believe the accusations against her. During her trial, witnesses claimed that she tore pages from the Bible with her specter, and bizarrely, workers found strange-looking dolls or poppets with pins stuck in them hidden within the walls of her tavern.
Freaking voodoo dolls.
Tavern, right. Pretty much. This was tangible proof, and the magistrates believed that she had been practicing forbidden magic. Tituba's story was one of the most overlooked yet most crucial in the Salem narrative. She was an enslaved woman, likely of indigenous or African descent, brought into Reverend Samuel Parris's household from the West Indies. Unlike the Puritan villagers, who saw the world in stark black and white terms of sin and salvation, Tituba carried with her a worldview shaped by oral traditions, storytelling, and spiritual practices that the Puritans neither understood or tolerated. So when the girls in the Parris' home began to convulse and cry out, the community looked at Tituba through the lens of suspicion. She was already, quote, other, so foreign, enslaved, marginalized, and that difference alone made her very vulnerable. But Tituba was also a storyteller. In the long New England winter, she shared folktales with Elizabeth Parris and Abigail Williams. She told of spirits and omens that blended English lore with Caribbean traditions. To the girls, these stories were thrilling, but to the adults of Salem, they carried danger. When Tituba was accused of witchcraft and dragged into interrogation, she knew the truth wouldn't save her. Beaten, threatened, and desperate, she told the magistrate what they wanted to hear. She spoke of the devil appearing to her, of black dogs, red cats, yellow birds, and specters that tormented the children. She described a tall man from Boston who forced her to sign his book, a book filled with many other names. Her confession was both survival strategy and performance. By weaving together Puritan fears with her own cultural imagery, she created a story so vivid, it gripped the court and electrified the town. Ironically, her attempt to protect herself lit the match that set Salem ablaze.
Damn.
Yep. The people believed her because she seemed to confirm what they had already feared. The devil was among them, and he wasn't working alone. Tituba, terrified, instead of simply denying the charges, painted a terrifying picture. But what she said next would change everything. She confessed that she was a witch, but only because the devil forced her. She said he appeared to her as a tall, black man who forced her to sign a book. A book that was massive and full of signatures. Tituba's blend of familiar and exotic demonic imagery made her testimony seem authentically terrifying, validating everything the Puritan magistrates had already believed, that a massive conspiracy of witches existed. Tituba's confession was the spark that turned local hysteria into a widespread, lethal hunt. So with the existence of a grand conspiracy now confirmed by Tituba, the trials moved into high gear. And they were not quiet affairs. They were spectacles, packed with villagers who came to watch their neighbors face judgment. The meeting house was stifling, filled with the stink of unwashed bodies, damp...
Ew! Yuck!
Damp wool cloaks and candle smoke that clung to the beams overhead. As the accused took the stand, the afflicted girls often sat in full view of the court, their bodies shaking, shrieking, clawing at invisible attackers. Gasps riddled through the audience as they claimed to see spirits perched on the rafters or hovering near the accused, whispering in their ears. Every scream, every fainting fit reinforced the belief that the devil was physically present in the room. The magistrates leaned in, their questions sharp and relentless. Have you made a pact with Satan? Who else have you seen with him? When did you sign the devil's book? The accused were trapped in a cruel paradox. Deny, and you were accused of lying under oath. Confess, and you damned yourself.
Shit, they couldn't win for losing.
Nope.
Well, that's kind of like prejudice today.
Yeah.
It really is.
You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. So it's like, what the fuck ever. Believe what you want to believe.
Exactly.
Either way, I'm wrong. So what the fuck ever. I don't care. That's basically what it is. Like,
oh, I know.
You know? Okay. So the most controversial and defining factor of these trials was the acceptance of spectral evidence. So think of it as convicting someone based on a dream.
Hell, I'd be under the fucking jail. Shit.
So it's just, you can't disprove something happening in a dream, but you also can't prove it happened.
Half a dozen one, six of the other.
Right. But it was evident. So the courtroom was so tense that you could feel the devil breathing at your neck. The afflicted girls would sit in the courtroom, and during testimony of the accused, their screams split the night like claws across glass. So there are records of the accusers testifying. So like Ann Putnam Jr., who claimed, quote, she struck me down in the night and pinched me so I could not breathe. The court used other bizarre rituals as well. What does that look for?
How could she pinch her until she couldn't
I think breathe? She means like chokes her.
Oh, okay.
I think is what she means. I could be wrong, but... just based off of how they talked back then, I think that's what she means, is that like she knocked her down in the night, or maybe came to her bed while she was laying down and then choked her.
Okay, now that makes more sense. Okay, that
I
makes
think
more
that's
sense.
What she means, but who knows, to be honest. These fucking people.
Excuse me.
These fucking people were crazy back then, so who fucking knows?
Right.
Okay, so the court used other bizarre rituals as well. One of the most famous was the touch test.
Okay.
If an afflicted girl fell into a convulsion, the accused witch would be forced to touch her. If the girl calmed down immediately, it was taken as proof that the witch had withdrawn their malevolent influence.
Okay.
Another test, almost too absurd to believe, but it's real, I promise, was the witch cake.
The what?
The witch cake.
Okay.
This involved taking the afflicted person's urine, baking it into a cake with ash, and feeding it to a dog on the theory that the dog, a witch's familiar, would be able to expose the poison. The court was truly operating on a magic system, not a legal one at this point.
I'm sorry, you did it without this. That cake would have been eight. Those are eight. That motherfucker wouldn't have cared.
He went and gave him. His dog eats spinach, for God's sakes. He eats off of a fork.
That was funny as hell.
Like, legit will eat off of a fork. He doesn't care. He'll eat a fucking plastic bag if it's got something that smells good in it. Okay, anyway. So, but the cruelty wasn't limited to that courtroom. The accused were often stripped and searched by court officials looking for a witch's teat.
I'm not even asked. It's going. Because I know what my brain's saying.
This was a skin abnormality, mole, or birthmark that the Puritans believed was a spot from which the witch's animal familiar would suckle blood from.
These were some sick puppies.
So weird. Just making shit up as they go, really, is all that is.
No, they were on some good drugs back then.
So,
that's where LSD came from.
So stupid. Okay, so the search for the witch's mark was a gruesome part of the court procedure, but it was often coupled with an even more terrifying ritual. Pricking. So in Europe, specialized witch finders were often hired. They would use long, silver-tipped needles to prick any mark found on the accused body. Moles, warts, birthmarks, scars, any mark. This was done under the belief that a true mark of the devil was a place where the witch had no feeling and could not bleed.
Most of that'll bleed if you prick it with something.
Mm-hmm. But if they pricked it and it didn't, and you didn't feel it, you're a witch.
Somebody prick me with something long, silver, and pin. I'm going to turn around and punch the motherfucker.
Mm-hmm. But you can act as though you're doing it, but not actually do it. And of course, there's not.
Yeah,
you're not going to cry in pain.
You're just going to gently touch it.
Right. It's not going to bleed, and you're not going to cry out in pain.
There were some sick bastards mm-hmm. back then.
Yeah. Okay. So while there is less evidence of a full-time professional witch pricker in Salem, the concept was certainly present in the Puritan thought. The accused were routinely subjected to this invasive, humiliating, and terrifying search. If they flinched or cried out, it was proof of their sensitivity and innocence. But if the needle pierced the skin without pain or blood, which could be easily faked, like we just said, researchers said that a lot of times they would use trick needles, or they would just find an area with a lot of callus, and just use that area.
Yeah, because that wouldn't bleed.
Mm-hmm. So they just faked the whole thing, like we just said. This was taken as absolute proof of their pact with the devil, even though this witch pricker could be full of shit. Yeah. So imagine that horror. You're stripped bare, subjected to a cold needle thrust into your skin by hostile strangers. Your life hanging on whether you cried out or stayed silent. It was a physical and psychological assault designed not to find evidence, but to coerce a confession.
There were some sadistic people back then.
Yep. So they did it under the guise of, oh, we're going to find evidence to whether you're innocent or guilty. But that's not what it was. They were torturing them.
Sadistic.
To give them to confess. Yep.
That's just.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of process where one's life was decided not by fate, but by theatrical performance and superstition, made the intellectual defiance of the accused all the more dangerous. So this brings us to the story of Martha Corey. Martha was a devout, respected member of the Salem Village Church. She was a gospel woman, as she called herself. Her accusation was a terrifying escalation, proving Satan would strike even the heart of the pious congregation. Unlike many of the marginalized women who went before her, Martha was a sharp intellectual. When the fits first began, she saw the transparent manipulation of the children and was one of the first to speak out publicly, declaring that the afflicted girls were fakes and liars. So she's like, no. You're full of shit. Basically, that's a direct quote, okay? You're full of shit. Stop being a little asshole. Get it together. Direct quote from Martha. Yeah. Her public skepticism sealed her fate. When she was brought before the magistrates, she refused to play the role of the terrified, confused victim. She stood upright, maintaining her innocence and challenging the very core premise of the court. As the afflicted girls in the room began their routine of screaming and convulsing, Martha only grew calmer, telling the magistrate, "The Lord knows I am innocent." The girls intensified their performance, claiming they saw a little yellow bird, Martha's familiar, suckling blood between her fingers. There's a little yellow bird right there.
Oh, brother.
Okay. They withered in agony, claiming Martha was biting her lip and through her specter was compelling them to bite their own lips. They even threw their shoe at her.
Damn, them girls need their asses spanked.
So Martha saw the performance and responded with dry, devastating sarcasm. When the magistrate asked why she had come to the examination, she responded, quote, "I have often wondered at it, that you should see not them, the afflicted girls, to be deluded," end quote. These bitches are crazy. That's what she's saying.
Yes.
She had the courage to say directly to the faces of the judges that they were all blinded by the devil. Her final recorded quote during the examination is heartbreakingly defiant. She said, quote, "We must not believe distracted persons." For the magistrates, this was intolerable insolence. Martha Corey was not just denying witchcraft. She was questioning the judgment of the court and the truth of its magistrates.
That's because they ain't got no fucking sense.
Right. So her defiance proved to the judges that she was an agent of evil, using her intelligence to fight God's will.
Oh.
Like, it's not funny, but it's...
It is funny because...
The idiocy of it is what's funny. But I get the times, okay, I guess. It fits with the time, fits with the era.
Yes, I agree. Yes, it fits with the era. But come on, people. Jeez.
Right. Some of it is just like, what in the hell is wrong with you? So Martha was convicted and hanged on September 22nd, 1692, alongside the others that I've mentioned, including aforementioned... So including George Burroughs and Martha Carrier, our unwavering dignity maintained until the moment that she was killed. It became a quiet, powerful symbol of the innocence that the trials refused to see. This hysteria consumed the vulnerable without expectation. The youngest person to be formally questioned was Dorothy Good. She was the 4-year-old daughter of Sarah Good.
Now I heard of her.
Yeah, and I tried not to do too much of, like Sarah Good and Tituba's story, because those are the big ones that are known. You think of the way that Salem witch trials, those are the ones you think of. A lot of the ones that I really dove into their stories,
you don't hear of them. A 4-year-old?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's because of who her mom was.
That 4-year-old got more sense than that magistrate does.
Right. So I know people are probably like, well, what about them? And obviously they're a part of the Salem story, but when everybody talks about Salem, those are the people you hear about. You hear about Sarah Good. You hear about Tituba. But you don't really hear about Dorothy or any of the other ones that I've mentioned so far. You just don't. So those are the ones that I did. I feel like they deserve
recognition.
Right. So after being subjected to relentless interrogation, this terrified 4-year-old child confessed to having a familiar. It was a little snake.
Mm-hmm.
And her snake familiar told her to hurt people.
Yeah.
She's 4. Mm-hmm. So when they asked her where the snake had come from, she simply pointed to her mother, Sarah. She's 4.
Who else she gonna...
Right. So Dorothy was shackled and spent 8 months in a cold, unforgiving prison.
That baby.
Mm-hmm.
Them fucking morons.
Yep. Yep. You missed it. It flew off. See, and until I did this, like, the stuff myself, I didn't know anything about Dorothy Good. Like, I'd heard of her mom, Sarah.
Yeah, but I'd never heard of the little girl.
I'd never heard of her.
She's just a baby.
Right. When Dorothy was finally released, she was emotionally broken and truly never recovered, which...
She's ready for the insane asylum by then.
Right. She was 4 years old, taken from her mom. She was shackled to a wall and spent 8 months in a prison. I don't think anybody would recover from that.
Yeah, would either.
So the witch trials of Salem spared no one, not even the smallest children who ended up caught in the crossfire of their parents' misfortune. So meanwhile, the accused were thrown into prisons. Often, essentially, they were dungeons. This is where disease, cold, and starvation ran rampant. These conditions are so inhumane that at least 5 people died in jail before ever making it to trial. The court created a terrifying paradox for the accused. Confessing to witchcraft was the only reliable way to save your life. Those who maintained their innocence were deemed unrepentant agents of Satan and sentenced to death. Over the course of 1692, the accusations expanded far beyond the village outcasts. Sarah Good was one of the earliest accused. She's one of the most popular and well-known. Her reputation made her an easy target at that time. She was poor, often seen begging for food and quick-tempered with her neighbors. During her trial, she refused to play meek or apologetic. At the gallows, she cursed the magistrates who condemned her, saying that she was no more a witch than they were. And from there, her defiance became legendary. Martha Carrier was so outspoken against local authorities that Cotton Mather himself dubbed her the Queen of Hell.
Damn.
The afflicted girls accused her of leading witch Sabbaths and killing neighbors' cattle with curses. Carrier denied everything, but her strong will only made her look guiltier. She was executed in August 1692, her reputation twisted into a weapon against her. George Burroughs, a former minister, faced one of the most infamous trials. He had been respected, even heroic, having once fought in Native American wars. But the girls accused him of being the ringleader of the witches. On the gallows, Burroughs recited the Lord's Prayer flawlessly, something witches were believed incapable of doing. Many spectators were moved to tears, believing this proved his innocence. Yet the execution went on, and he was hanged anyway. His death remains one of the clearest examples of reasons drowned by hysteria. If the story of Salem is defined by its victims, it is also defined by the few who possess the clarity and courage to publicly challenge the proceedings. No one exemplifies this doomed resistance more than John Proctor, which I'm sure you've heard of. Most people that know Salem know of John Proctor. So John Proctor was not a pauper or an outcast. He was a 60-year-old successful farmer and tavern keeper who was fiercely independent and known for his loud, blunt opinions. When a servant girl, Mary Warren, began suffering fits and joining the circle of accusers, John Proctor was furious. He did not accept the devil as an explanation. He saw manipulation and malice. And in 1692, when Mary Warren first claimed she was being afflicted, John literally beat her to her senses, threatening to drag her to the whipping post. He famously declared that the afflicted girls deserved to be whipped until they lost their desire to practice witchcraft. This was a man standing up against the entire tide of the village, seeing the girls as imposters, not as victims. But John's courage was a double-edged sword. When he tried to stop Mary Warren's fits, she turned on him, screaming that Elizabeth Proctor, his wife, was torturing her. So Elizabeth was already a target. She was disliked by the powerful Putnam family, who were neighbors and rivals in the tavern business. She was also seen as cold and reserved, which is a dangerous quality in a community such as this. Elizabeth was arrested first. John was determined to fight for her, though. He didn't hire a lawyer, which during this time was almost impossible to get one anyway. But he took on the court himself, writing passionate letters to the magistrates in Boston, begging them to relocate the trials and appoint educated, impartial judges rather than their local clergy. He called the entire system a dangerous sham. His letters were brave, but only served to draw a target on his own back. The accusers realized that to maintain the power of the trials, they had to silence the man who spoke the truth the loudest. The girls, especially Abigail Williams, began to accuse John directly and repeatedly. They described his specter forcing them to sign the devil's book. His wife was already shackled in prison at this point, and he was left alone on his farm with his other children, because they have children, watching as the court machinery prepared to devour him just as it was his wife. In the courtroom, John Proctor mounted a remarkable defense. He challenged the integrity of the magistrates and directly denounced the spectral evidence, arguing it was inherently flawed because only the accuser could see the, quote, proof. He stood on his dignity, his reputation, and his clear history of piety. But the most damning moment came when Mary Warren, under intense pressure, finally recanted her accusation against the Proctors, admitting to the court that she had lied and that all the girls were lying. She declared, quote, I have wronged them all. For a brief, shining moment, it seemed that the truth might prevail. But the court, unwilling to admit the trials were biased on lies, rejected her recantation. So they're like, no, girlfriend, you didn't lie. You didn't lie. The devil's making you say that. You told the truth. Yep. The other girls immediately surrounded Mary, screaming that John Proctor's specter was afflicting her for telling the truth. Suddenly, Mary Warren was overcome by the crowd and the pressure. She broke down, reserved her retraction, and fell back in with the accusers, screaming again that John Proctor was the devil's man.
Mm-hmm.
John Proctor was condemned, and even as he faced the gallows, he showed extraordinary humanity. He was not just fighting for his life. He was fighting for his family's honor. He penned a final moving appeal, not just to the court, but to the most influential ministers in Boston, asking them to intervene and begging for a brief reprieve so he could make a final clear statement before his execution. His plea was ignored. On August 19, 1692, John Proctor was hanged alongside George Burroughs, Martha Carrier, and three others. He was the wealthiest man executed in the trials, and he was the most vocal critic to date, proving that wealth and social standing were no shield against the Salem storm. Elizabeth Proctor, however, survived.
I'm surprised.
She was pregnant during the height of this hysteria. And according to English common law, an unborn child could not be killed. Therefore, her execution was delayed until after the birth of her child. When the hysteria finally subsided and Governor Phibbs ordered an end to the executions in 1693, Elizabeth was still in jail, having given birth. She was freed, but her ordeal was not over. Because John had been convicted as a felon and a witch, the law decreed that the state seize all of his property, effectively bankrupting Elizabeth and their surviving children. She spent the next decade fighting in court, not for her reputation, but for the basic right to own the land that her husband had been executed on. She petitioned the government, begging them to overturn the attainder on John's property. And it wasn't until 1711, nearly 20 years later, that the government finally reversed John's conviction, allowing her and her children to recover the family estate. The story of the Proctors is a classic tragedy. John's heroic courage led directly to his demise, while Elizabeth's pregnancy, a twist of legal fate, saved her life, only to leave her fighting a legal battle that lasted longer than the witch trials themselves.
Damn.
Now, Rebecca Nurse is another well-known. She was 71 years old when she stood accused. She was a woman known for her piety, her kindness, and her devotion to the church. She was the last person that most in Salem would have expected to see branded as a servant to the devil. So at first, the court actually found her not guilty of witchcraft. But when the verdict was read, the afflicted girls erupted into a frenzy, screaming, writhing, crying out that her specter was still tormenting them. And the noise was so overwhelming that the magistrates pressed the jury to reconsider. So under pressure, the jury reversed itself, and Rebecca Nurse was condemned.
See, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Her neighbors were horrified. Nearly 40 villagers signed a petition attesting to her innocence, calling her a woman of blameless life. But in Salem of 1692, reason held no sway against fear. And on July 19th, Rebecca Nurse was hanged on Gallows Hill. Witnesses said she met her fate with calm dignity, declaring before God and man that she was innocent. Her death sent shockwaves through the community. If someone as upright and devout as Rebecca Nurse could be condemned, then no one, not even the most respected, was safe. So next we have the story of Giles Corey, which we talked about his wife. This story is perhaps the most darkest moment in the entire trial. At 80 years old, he refused to enter a plea when he was accused of witchcraft. His silence was not cowardice. It was strategy. By refusing to plead, he prevented the court from legally being able to try him. And in doing so, it protected his land from being seized by the authorities. His heirs would inherit the land, and the state couldn't take it because he didn't plead.
Yeah, for him.
Yep. But the punishment for refusing to plead was brutal.
What'd they do to that old man?
Remember, he's 80 years old. Corey was stripped, bound, and laid in an open field. Heavy boards were placed across his chest, and stones were stacked one by one on top of him.
Oh, man, they crushed him to death.
Witnesses described the slow, deliberate cruelty of the pressing. That's what it's called. Each day, more stones were added. His ribs cracked. His body heaved against the crushing weight. Sheriff George Corwin, overseeing this torture, is said to have taunted him, demanding a plea. Corey's only response through broken breaths was more weight. For 2 days, he endured this agony. Mm-hmm. On the third day, his chest gave way, and he died there in the field, his body mangled under the weight of the stones. But his defiance became legend. Giles Corey refused to bend, and his last words were remembered as an unshakable act of resistance against tyranny. He died without confessing, and in doing so, denied the court its power over him. Because he's gone now.
They can't do nothing to him.
His heirs, his children, get his entire estate. Because he did not plead guilty or not guilty. And because he didn't plead, they can never try him. So the state couldn't take anything that belonged to him.
That's just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's smart on the old man.
Right, but he's 80 years old. Come on, people. Like, he's going to die any day at this point. It's the 1600s. Like, Chin, you're lucky if you see 10 in the 1600s, let alone 80. Leave the poor man alone. Obviously, he's doing something right. That's probably why he was accused, to be honest. I don't actually know. But that was probably part of it, because he was so damn old.
Probably.
Ridiculous. So by September 1692, 19 people had been hanged on Gallows Hill. Mm-hmm. And they were not hanged like in the traditional sense.
Okay.
You know, like they're dropped. They were not dropped cleanly to break their necks. Instead, they were oftentimes turned off a ladder, leading to a slow, agonizing death by strangulation.
Ouch!
Mm-hmm. Yep. Because typically, when you go, you know, that big...
The gallows. like a stage.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to come out. You go on the stage, there's the lever.
They have a
drop. It drops underneath. And you fall.
Right.
Well, that quick descent, it typically breaks your neck. And that's essentially what kills you. The rope is just kind of there to hold you, so your neck will break.
Right. So you can go all the way to the ground.
Right. Here, basically, they were put on top of a ladder, tied around their neck in a tree or whatever they had. And essentially, the ladder was knocked from underneath them.
Or a chair or whatever.
Right. That's essentially what they did.
That's crazy.
So they just couldn't breathe. They slowly suffocated to death. And that takes several minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas the other way, the normal gallows, it's instant because your neck breaks. And it breaks in the right spot.
Yeah.
To instantly kill you. Yeah. So they weren't just killing these people. They literally tortured them until they died. Yeah. So the jails were bursting of people that have been accused. But by the very thing that made the panic so effective, the use of that spectral evidence, is what would ultimately end the witch trials.
Because they were running out of fucking people to accuse.
So the accusers, emboldened by their power, began pointing fingers higher and higher up that social ladder. The trials were already horrifying. But then the accusations reached the governor's own home. They accused the wife of the governor, Lady Mary Phipps. This was the terrifying turning point. Governor Phipps, who had been away fighting King William's War, returned to Boston by this point and was horrified to find that his wife, had been named among those accused. His personal fear for his family forced his hand. Phipps was forced to literally sign the warrant that officially dissolved the court of Oyer and Terminer, I believe that's how you say those two, and it halted all further proceedings and executions. So he did that to save his wife. Fuck everybody else.
I get that.
Fuck everybody else. Yeah. You couldn't have done something before, my guy?
Well, he wasn't there, honey.
I feel like you knew what was going on, okay? War or no war? You're the governor.
Well, it wasn't like they had cell phones back in those days.
Well, either way, not only that, who was acting as governor while he was away?
I don't know. I don't know if they had a lieutenant governor
back. I have no idea. But you get what I'm saying? Like, somebody knew. Somebody could have done something before your wife, sir, was being marched to the gallows. Now you want to do something. Kind of fucked up. Just saying. Anyway, so public opinion was already beginning to shift. But the decisive moral and legal authority came from Increase Mather. He issued the famous caution, quote, "It were better than 10 suspected witches should escape than that one innocent person should be condemned." And the executions were stopped. So Innocent Mather, he's like, it's better that 10 witches get away than we sit and we kill just one innocent person. So he's like, we're done. So even today, Gallows Hill has a silence that feels heavier than the earth itself. The physical executions of 1692 were tragic. But the economic fallout of the trials created a second lingering tragedy that lasted for decades. This element is often forgotten in the tale of Salem, yet it speaks volumes about the darker motivations that were at play. The legal system of the time was very rigid for disaster. When a person was accused, they were immediately imprisoned. They or their family were then charged the cost of their own incarceration. So fees for their shackles, their food, the cost of the jailer's labor, and even the cost of the execution itself. If the person was convicted, the state then seized all of their assets. The courts would then pay themselves, the sheriff, and the jailers from the victim's confiscated property. So this created a profound financial incentive to find people guilty.
Well, yeah, because it's ill-gotten gains.
Right. So for the jailers, the sheriff, and the magistrates, the trials were not just a matter of theological duty. They were a potential source of income. The financial ruin was absolute. Families often had to sell their own possessions, their cattle, or even their own homes just to pay for the prison fees for an innocent relative who would eventually become acquitted. So consider the case of Sarah Good's 4-year-old daughter, Dorothy. When she was released, her mother was dead, her father was ruined, and the Paris family still demanded payment for the child's 8 months in jail. The worst impact was on the women that were released. When the hysteria ended in 1693, the jail doors opened, but the former prisoners had nowhere to go. They were destitute, weakened by months of cold and starvation, and indebted to the state for the cost of their own imprisonment. The families of the accused, like Elizabeth Proctor, had to fight for years to simply recover the value of their property, let alone their reputations. The law of attainder, or the removal of a convicted felon's civil rights, confiscation of their property, meant the families were essentially rendered illegal in their own colony. It wasn't until 1711, nearly 2 decades after the hangings, that the Massachusetts government finally passed a legislative act to provide some form of restitution for the surviving victims and the families of the executed. It took them 20 years to do that.
That's crazy.
But this compensation was minimal. It was an insult to the families that had suffered. The entire sum allotted by the government to compensate the 22 surviving families was £578.
That's nuts.
Which, to U.S. dollars, is $777 between 22 families.
They had to split that $700?
Mm-hmm. That was the total compensation given to 22 surviving families.
That ain't shit.
Mm-hmm. This was a pittance that barely covered the years of legal fees and lost income.
They got $35.32.
Yep. Each. Yep. Mm-hmm. So even this paltry sum was not easy to claim, even though it's theirs, but it wasn't easy for them to claim. And the long, bitter process of petitioning the government for that compensation kept the trauma of 1692 alive for yet another generation.
Jeez Louise. That's just fucking nuts.
Mm-hmm. So the true tragedy of the Salem trials, therefore, wasn't just the 19 bodies that hung on Gallows Hill. It was the complete systematic destruction of a quarter of the community, leaving behind a legacy of debt, legal chaos, and spiritual bankruptcy that poisoned Salem for decades. The Salem trials ended in 1693, but their shadow stretched far beyond that. In 1706, Ann Putnam Jr., the child who had made so many accusations, stood before her church and confessed. She admitted that she had been deceived by Satan and that her false testimony had condemned innocent lives. With tears, she begged for forgiveness from the families of the victims. Her confession was powerful, but for many, it was too little, too late.
No shit. I'm surprised she's still walking.
Judges and jurors wrestled with guilt. Samuel Sewall issued a formal apology in 1697. He acknowledged his role in the bloodshed. Others, like Staunton, never repented, insisting the trials had been just. Families of the executed petitioned the government for restitution. In the decades that followed, some were granted small sums of money, like we said, but no amount of compensation could undo their grief.
Oh, hell no.
And yet, the injustice persisted for centuries. Though most victims were pardoned by the colonial government in 1711, it took nearly, are you ready?
I'm listening.
300 years to clear all of their names.
I believe it.
In fact, it was not until 2001 that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts finally passed legislation to clear the last final five names. And that included Susanna Martin, and unbelievably, Elizabeth Johnson Jr., who was another woman convicted in 1693, but she had not been officially exonerated by the state until July of 2022.
Good God.
So the process of healing Salem's wounds was a matter of centuries, demonstrating just how sticky and difficult it can be to undo a profound historical wrong. So Salem itself has forever been scarred, the community fractured, neighbors unable to forget the betrayals that had taken place. Even generations later, descendants carried the weight of the trials, their family names linked forever to either the accusers or the accused. The witch trials weren't just a tragedy of 1692. They became a wound in the American conscience that has never fully healed. Today, modern science offers concrete explanation for the fits and symptoms that so terrified 17th century Salem. So are you ready to find out what caused?
Spoiled bride-itis?
Nope. It's a good one, though. So the leading theory among scientists today, for many years, has been ergot poisoning.
Who'd what?
Ergot poisoning.
The hell is that?
So this is caused by a fungus on rye grain, which is common in cold, damp climates like New England.
Okay.
Ergot poisoning is chemically related to the drug LSD.
Thank you very much. I said that earlier.
And its effects can include violent convulsions, frightening hallucinations, a creeping sensation on the skin, and severe spasms. Symptoms that match the girl's documented behavior precisely.
I told you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they were eating moldy bread. And they were getting a little too high. That's what was happening. It was fucking them up.
A little too high?
Don't eat moldy bread, guys.
I don't. I throw it away.
So another widely accepted theory is mass psychogenic illness or mass hysteria.
Yeah.
So this theory suggests that
I like the LSD theory better.
I think it's a mixture of the two. I think it's both.
Well, back then they didn't have refrigeration right. Like we do, mm-hmm. and you know all the safeguards that we have with food and stuff.
Yeah,
like we do today. Back then,
yeah, you didn't, and then you got rid of it.
No, you picked the mold off and you kept eating.
Ew.
No, I'm serious, honey.
That's why people got poisoned all the damn time. That's why didn't nobody live to be 80 years old. Everybody eating moldy, nasty food and getting...
Well, that's like with their meat. They covered it in salt to preserve it.
Oh. I always wondered why they did that.
Yeah.
I never really looked. I never had a reason to know that. I just wondered. Huh. Okay, so... There's a mass. This theory, the mass hysteria theory, suggests that the combination of extreme Puritan stress, war trauma, and poor diet created a fertile ground for psychological breakdown. So when a few central figures began displaying these physical symptoms, the suggestibility of the other children, who were already deeply traumatized and malnourished, caused them to genuinely believe that they were afflicted, leading to that rapid unconscious spread of the symptom. So I think it's a mixture of both. Some of them did end up with ergot poisoning, and because of the time and everything that was going on, and their children.
They need their butts whooped.
The kids are, like, mentally, their brains are saying something's wrong with you. This is what's happening to you.
Right.
When it's really not. That's what I think a lot of it was. I think it was both. And it got out of hand. Yeah. So for some of the individual victims, modern medicine suggests a third, more common phenomenon, sleep paralysis. So in this state, okay, hear me out. In this state, individuals often experience genuine sensations of being choked, seeing shadowy figures or specters, and being held by a force that they could not fight. A literal interpretation of being attacked by an invisible witch. Because they were talking about spectral dreams.
Now, there was four brats that needed their butts whooped.
Well, I think some of that's it. Some of them were, but just kind of like, oh, this seems fun. But I don't think all of them were. I believe some of them were sick. I think some of it was mass hysteria. And maybe there were a few that were just like, oh, this seems fun. Let's do this. I'm bored.
Actually, it kind of sounds like schizophrenia.
Yeah, but not on that level. That's a lot to all of a sudden, you know what I mean?
They could have a psychotic break.
I mean, that's possible too.
And back then, they didn't know what that was.
Right. I think it's a little bit of all of it.
I still think they just need their butts whooped. Go get a willow stick. Yeah, baby.
So ultimately, there is no single theory, whether psychological, biological, or environmental, that can fully explain the outbreak.
That's true. That is true.
The truth likely rests in a terrifying combination of all of them.
Yeah.
Like I said, a perfect storm of stress, superstition, and circumstance that transformed a small town into a theater of terror.
Yeah, because see, like, go back to the food part. Their milk wasn't pasteurized like ours is.
Yep.
You know, they drank it straight from the cow.
Yep.
They didn't refrigerate it.
Who knows what the cow had?
Thank you.
What the cow eat?
But there was no refrigeration.
Nope.
So if you had a pail of milk, you had to drink it and use it all that day. Otherwise, it was going to... Ew, can you imagine the smell?
Ew, God, no. You're going to make me gag.
I was making myself gag. What are you talking about?
Oh. And then you have the rye that causes the ergot poisoning, the fungus.
Yeah.
That was very, very common during that time.
Yep. Because there was no preserver. That's why we have preservatives in all of our damn...
Right. Family. I know. This thing, everybody, like, no offense to anybody, everybody gets mad because we have all these preservatives. But stuff like this is why.
Exactly. It's well, so, some of it don't.
Yeah, some of it is unnecessary. Some of it is very unnecessary. Okay? Like, I don't want fucking wax on my cheese. What the hell does that preserve? That's fucking weird. Okay? Anyway. Sorry. Anyhow. A lot of... Some of it is shit. Shouldn't be in there. But there are, it's there for a reason, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yep, we're getting off topic.
I know. It's a whole other subject. Okay, so anyway. So before we wrap it up, okay, we have to talk about the version of the Salem story that most people know. Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible. It is a masterpiece of drama and a brilliant metaphor for the McCarthy era, but it is not history. So I don't know if you know that play.
I don't think so.
Called The Crucible.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, you're not really into plays anyway.
No.
But
unless it's Medea.
Right. But for anyone for anyone that does know The Crucible, it is not history. Okay. It is rooted in lies for the sake of drama. The Crucible is a big reason why Salem is known today, but most of it is false. So, for example, Miller makes Abigail Williams a powerful, scorned 17-year-old lover of John Proctor. But the real Abigail was only 11 or 12 years old, and there was no evidence that she ever worked for the Proctors or even knew them. The real John Proctor was a 70-year-old tavern keeper, like I said, not a young heroic farmer that is portrayed in the play. Miller also claims that Betty Parris's mother was dead. She was very much alive and living inside the Parris home. Most significantly, Miller's central dramatic conflict, Abigail leading the charge as a scorned woman gaining revenge, oversimplifies a complex web of land disputes, church politics, and deep-seated paranoia. It takes the focus away from the systematic failures and places it on a fictionalized love triangle. The true, more frightening story is that these horrors happened not because of teenage jealousy, but because of an entire society, from the highest judges to the lowliest farmers. They chose to believe a lie created by kids. The shadow of Salem stretches forward throughout centuries. Each time society succumbs to the hysteria, the echoes of 1692 return. So in the 1950s, the Red Scare gripped America. Careers and reputations were destroyed by accusations of communism.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. That's what is
most... I wasn't born yet, yeah. But...
So this same pattern emerged. The accused could never fully prove their innocence, while the accusers gained power simply by pointing a finger. Then, in the 1980s, the satanic panic swept across the United States. Families and daycare workers were accused of being part of hidden cults based on the fantastical claims of children and amplified by media frenzy. Lives were ruined before reason eventually prevailed, including, you know, the most common ones that suffered through the satanic panic. True crime world. The West Memphis Three.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were fingered and convicted simply because of the music they liked and the way they dressed. Because of the satanic panic.
That's just people are stupid. And that's why I stay to myself.
Yep. They've been acquitted or they've been...
exonerated.
Right. All that since then. But still, that's a big one. So, and today... okay, we have the digital era. And the digital age has birthed an entire new kind of witch hunt. So online mob forms is, in an instant, fueled by rumors, outrage, and viral posts. Accusations spread faster than facts. Reputations are destroyed in hours, and truth often struggles to catch up.
Truth always has trouble catching up.
And in the digital era, it's even harder. Because once it's out there forever.
That's why I was born. I was glad I was born when I did, because all stupid shit I did, there's no record of it.
Hey, I had MySpace in my day, and there's still ain't record of my stupid shit. Okay, you just gotta be smart about what you put on the internet.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I really didn't do a lot of stupid shit, though. Not really.
No, not really.
Not till I got older.
You were a pretty good kid. Even when you got older, you were still a pretty good kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always knew where you were at, and I always knew who you were with, mm-hmm. and you'd always call me if you weren't coming home, and so I wouldn't worry. So, yeah, you were a good kid.
I didn't always do the smartest shit, but hey, my friends did worse shit, okay?
Yeah, they did.
I was the smart one out of the bunch. Like, guys, I don't know about this. I don't think this is a good idea. Maybe we shouldn't do this. I'm gonna sit over here. Have fun. I'm staying out of
fun with that.
Right. Okay. Anyway, sorry. Tangent. Anyway, so while the fear of spectral witches may have vanished centuries ago, the lessons of Salem haven't. The spirit of Salem's panic is still with us today. It's just in a different form. The persecution seen here didn't end in 1692. We had the Red Scare of the 1950s, the Satanic Panic of the 1980s, and in all of these instances, the crucial lesson is the accuser's advantage. By simply pointing a finger, a young girl could condemn a respected elder. And the power of dynamic was instantly inverted. This vulnerability of the accused, the difficulty of proving a negative, is a pattern that we constantly recognize, whether the charge is witchcraft or something else entirely. Today, digital mob forms online at the speed of a click. Accusations spread faster than facts. This is the modern equivalent of the touch test and the spectral evidence.
The very term.
The tools change, but the danger of unchecked fear never does. The story of Salem underscores the necessity of skepticism, evidence-based reasoning, and courage to stand against the mob. History repeats itself when society allows rumor, superstition, and panic to eclipse rationality, and Salem holds that mirror up for us. Now, ultimately, let us remember the victims, people like Rebecca Nurse, Giles Corey, and Sarah Good. Let their stories guide us to question boldly, to resist the allure of panic, and to value truth, fairness, and humanity above all else. And that is our detailed look at the Salem Witch Trials.
Damn.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
There's a lot in there you didn't know, huh?
I know.
I like when I can do that, when I can take well-known things and find stuff that you really don't hear. I love whenever I can do that.
You're very good at it too.
I don't feel like I'm just retelling the same old worn out story. You know what I mean?
You're explaining it.
Right. Because a lot of, especially with the type of podcast that we have, a lot of this stuff has been told so many times.
But not to that depth.
And that's why I love whenever I can take something and add to it to make it different. Like the JonBenet Ramsey, I swore I wasn't going to do it. Said I was not going to touch it. It's done every year. It's been overdone. Everybody knows it.
20 years. I mean, come on.
Mandy really wanted to do it. But she's like, I can't do it the level that you can. I'm not going to touch it. I'm not going to do it. So I finally did it. And I'm glad I did it because there was a lot of stuff that I found on my own that I never knew about. I'm glad I did it. Anyway, sorry, guys. Okay. So next episode you're going to get today is Fridays. Haunted Lakes.
Last Fridays.
Yeah, last Fridays. Sorry. Haunted Lakes. That's going to come out later today. And then this Friday, so our next episode, make sure you join us because we are going to travel across the ocean to a dark corner of Scotland. A land where the fear of the devil was 5 times more lethal per capita than anywhere else in Europe.
Damn.
We will tell you the story. Bulgarian witches, a mass execution spurred by the fits of one single child, where the condemned were strangled and then their bodies were burned to ashes.
That gum.
Ensuring the devil could not resurrect them. At the site where the ashes of the condemned witches were finally buried, the fearful townspeople wanted to ensure that the ground itself was safe and the malice could never rise again. So, they placed a large horseshoe over that grave, an ancient protective charm against evil, and paved the road right over it. Today, that spot is marked by a cross on the pavement at Maxwellton Cross in Paisley, a cold, simple marker over the remnants of the dead, a permanent reminder of a community's fear. It is a chilling story of greed, betrayal, and relentless accusation. So make sure you come back on Friday for that one.
Shoot, I may have to come back on Friday.
Hopefully that sucked everybody in. It's a good one. I had never heard of this one from Friday. Yeah, I had no idea. It's a good one. So good. So make sure you subscribe, rate, and review so that way you can get notification when next Friday's episode drops. Sure you come back for that one. You're going to love it. And until then, remember to
watch out for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.